Hey everybody, I think we'll go ahead and get started. We're going to wait for some people to trickle in. We're going to go ahead and open this up for a informational hearing. Today is Tuesday, February 2nd, and we're in the Ways and Means Subcommittee of Natural Resources, and we're doing an informational hearing. We won't be voting, and so we can go ahead and start without a quorum, but our colleagues will come trickling in, I'm certain, and here is Representative Parrish. Yay, thank you. So I think we will, let's go ahead, and we're going to be talking about Department of Fish and Wildlife and their budget, and so we'll go ahead unless you have something else to share.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I would just note that we posted right before the meeting the Secretary of State audit of the Department of Fish and Wildlife on OLA, so that's available for folks to look at.
Yes, I asked Mr. Siebert to put the recent audit from January 2016 from the Secretary of State's office on there, and I want to draw attention to the committee members. If you go into OLIS and looking at the recommendations that are in there, because it's talking about some suggestions that they have about how Department of Fish and Wildlife can improve its budgeting process. So I think we'll go ahead and ask Kurt Melcher and Bill, the Director of Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Bill Herber, the Deputy Director, to come up, and they have a presentation ready for us, and we can go ahead and go through that.
Madam Co-Chair, just for the record, I've got to testify at 9 o'clock, so I'll get up. It isn't any disrespect to the presenters, but if I leave, I'll be back.
Just time it right, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Hansel.
Very good.
Morning.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Kurt Melcher. I'm the director with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, and thank you, Co-Chair Taylor, for the introductions. Of course, I have Bill Herber here with me, my Deputy Director for Administration, and then Kathy Connolly with Department of Administrative Service Budget and Management, our budget officer on the DAS side. So I appreciate the opportunity to come here today and give you an update on the department's budget and financial situation. Of course, we had a lot of discussions about that over the last year. As we look here at a photo from the Trask River, I believe that's fall Chinook fishing on the Trask River. We'll start just talk a little bit, give a little bit of background on the department, but I won't spend a lot of time on these. Of course, the department's charged with managing all fish and wildlife in the state, not just species that are hunted and fished. We manage species ranging from coastal mollusks like sea urchins and variety of plant populations, all the way up to apex predators, wolves, cougars on the terrestrial side, and everything in between. Fishing and hunting and wildlife viewing is big business in the state. Roughly, based on a study that we worked with Travel Oregon on, about $1 billion in spending annually in the state of Oregon associated with fishing, hunting, and wildlife viewing. And those benefits trickle down through all the counties. For the first time, as a result of that study, we had the ability to look at spending, travel spending, by county scale, and in many of our particularly rural counties, over 40% of the travel expenditures in those counties are associated with fishing, hunting, or wildlife viewing. Department operates about 94 facilities around the state, includes 32 fish hatcheries. I think we have a facility in virtually every county, as well as 16 wildlife management areas that are staffed, and about 30 district or regional offices. Moving then on to the budget piece of this discussion, as we talked about through the last legislative session, the budget challenges that we're facing the department and were highlighted in the Secretary of State's audit, both the financial audit from last year, from 2015, as well as the performance audit that was released here early in 2016. A number of challenges that have faced the department included low operating cash reserves, which were really impacting our ability to implement programs. Fishing and hunting participation over the last decade has basically been flat. When that's flat on a total participation levels, if you look at it on a per capita basis, as the state's population has continued to expand, the per capita participation has continued to decline. At the same time, we have increasing demands for service and increasing management complexity, ranging from issues like alternative energy development to managing new or restored predator populations. In this case, we're looking at a photo here of a wolf that the department spends a lot of resources in managing wolves. And then additionally, not unlike other entities, we're always faced with the increasing costs of our operations, ranging from the standard inflationary type pressures, but also increasing costs related to personnel and employee benefits. The department's budget is fully 50% of our budget comes to us directly associated with fishing and hunting. So a large percentage of that, 37% of the total budget, is related to hunter and angler license sales. And about 13% comes to us as federal funds, excise funds on arms and ammunition, and fishing tackle that is then redistributed to the state. So 50% of the agency budget is directly related to hunting and fishing. A large component of federal funds predominantly coming to us in the form of mitigation for a variety of activities. The largest one certainly is operating federally funded fish hatcheries. And then you'll see, and as you all know, a small lottery component, a general fund component, and then obligated. And these obligated funds are dollars that are obligated for specific purposes. They're not fungible. I'll talk really briefly about, I mentioned this already, the decadal-long trend in hunting participation. And you'll see the participation rates are generally flat, both for residents and non-residents. And a very similar graphic for recreational angling participation, generally flat participation over the last decade. Of course, if you display that in terms of per capita, both of those would be per capita declining participation. Legislatively, our legislative approved budget for the 15-17 biennium is over 50% of the agency is fish-related programs, with about 25% wildlife and 25% included in a combination of administration, state police enforcement, debt service, capital improvement. Another way of looking at it is that our total other funds, these would be non-federal, non-general, non-lottery funds, are also about 50% of the budget at $169 million, with federal funds there, a full roughly one-third of the agency's legislative-approved budget. I want to talk just briefly, we're going to get into a lot of details here on other fund and our other fund ending balances here in the future, but we really have three primary kinds of other fund, if you will. First and foremost, our license, what we call license other funds. License other funds come to us, are generated by the sales of fishing licenses and hunting licenses. Very importantly to us, these license funds, they're truly fungible, and they're what we use as operating capital for the agency, as well as for the general operations of our facilities, our regional district regional fish and wildlife biologists. We also have obligated other funds. Obligated other funds are obtained through contractual obligations. Those would be non-federal contractual obligations, and they're used for specific purposes, consistent with the terms of those contracts. Included in that are federal indirect. So with each federal contract, we receive indirect for agency administration. And then the third category under other fund are dedicated funds. And these are funds, revenues that come to the department that are legislatively dedicated for other purposes. So when an individual purchases an angling license, for instance, there's a number of surcharges associated with that angling license. There's a hatchery research center surcharge, a fish passage surcharge, a fish screening surcharge, a restoration enhancement surcharge. All of those surcharges come to us. They are other fund, but they're dedicated for specific purposes, not for general agency operations. So in looking back then, about a year ago, a little over a year ago, as we were tracking, and this is a graphic of our other fund cash balances, two primary kinds of other fund, if you will, the red line indicating our dedicated and obligated ending fund cash balances, and the blue line indicating our license-related other fund cash balances. And you'll see, I mean, if you drew a line, if you fit a line to that data set, it would certainly be a declining line. And you'll see many of those ending, these are monthly ending balances. Many of those monthly ending balances were on the x-axis at zero. Actually, none of them were actually zero. I think the lowest month was balance was $1.38 we had in our account. So couldn't have bought a cup of coffee with our monthly ending balance in that particular month. So as we looked at developing, and of course in 2015, we were in the end of our six-year fee cycle. As we looked at developing our next six-year cycle, our next six-year budget process, we were confronted with these ending balances, these cash reserve issues, as were also highlighted in the Secretary of State's audit. We projected then our, and you've all seen this before during our Ways and Means process, but we projected out our operational expenses over the next 6 years and assumed no new revenue, assumed that our programs were going to be operating at full capacity, basically current service level. And you'll see, and as was widely reported, a significant gap between expected license revenues and projected expenditures for 6 years. We one of the key, as we looked at the operational reserve graph, the monthly ending balance graph, one of our key objectives as we moved forward then about a year ago was to restore the operating reserve, which was very important for us. We based those budget projections that we saw in the earlier slide and this slide on several key assumptions, and I mentioned some of them, but we basically assumed that there would be no additional revenue, that there would be no increase in sales of our licenses, that our license revenue would be flat. We projected that we would fully fund programs. We would not hold vacancies unnecessarily. If we were looking out prospectively, we would not hold vacancies. That we would have increased costs due to inflation, of course, and that we would fully fund the state police fish and wildlife component of our budget, which we had been holding back on for several biennia due to cash flow issues.
Excuse me, Mr. Melcher, I'm going to interrupt you for 1 second. So we've been having a lot of conversations about cash flow analysis, et cetera, and obviously wanting to be supportive of trying to get the cash flow situation under control. And we had also talked about what assumptions were being used and projecting forward. And I realized that the performance audit that came out from the Secretary of State's office only came out in January, so maybe right. It's too recent. But I noticed in here that one of the recommendations is to extend the financial forecast beyond 6 years, that perhaps that's one of the problems that we're having, is that we're using a six-year, due to the legislative biennium or whatever reason, we're using that metric, and maybe it needs to be extended out further in order to better manage the cash flow situation. I was just wondering what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Co-Chair Taylor. Thanks for that question. We certainly, we're now actually, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of our revenue models here in some upcoming slides, but we've really been working to improve our technical analytical abilities as it relates to projecting, in particular, license sales. Mm-hmm. And so we will be in a place that we can do that better in the future. That is for, and we'll show a little bit of some of our improvements.
Okay, all right. We'll wait for that moment then. Okay.
I think one of the important things to note is, and the Secretary of State's audit mentioned that we were, in previous biennia, we had been overly optimistic on our revenue forecasts. And so what I'm saying, and we're going to talk about it, but we're never going to be perfect.
No.
But the key is there bias around your ability? And so hopefully we will be removing that bias and improving our ability to forecast in the future. Obviously, the more years you go out, the more uncertainty there is, though, because there's other pressures at play
However, one can do both, right? You can
absolutely.
So this is what we're looking at, what's happening throughout the year, because we know now that we're having certain months where the revenue really goes up and then it's really low. So we need to obviously be doing this on an annual basis, perhaps a six-year basis, and then perhaps longer term out, and then up to 10 years or with something, because we need to, this is our goal, but I'll let you, let's go ahead and start working through this. So
as we looked at that budget gap, we had a number of approaches to filling that budget gap. One piece of that was a fee adjustment, fee increase that was embodied in Senate Bill 247. One of our, you know, we recognize that we're competing basically in a recreational marketplace for discretionary participants. The vast, vast majority of our fee-paying customers are not. They can choose to do other activities. They are not. It's not like a professional license where they're compelled and they have to pay us. They can. They make their own judgment. They make their own decisions, cost-benefit decisions based on the value. And so, one of our really key interests in as we adjusted fees was to minimize the impact on participation. We did a lot of surveying of our customers to determine what was the preferred approach. We utilized that information as we made our proposal last session. But we wanted to have strategic adjustments rather than just simply across the board. And when I say strategic, we wanted to minimize or hopefully even reduce the cost for families to participate. We wanted to make sure that we have these customers who are on the margin that are not avid. They're on the margins, and we wanted to make sure that we were strategic in our efforts to keep the folks that we have that are on the margins and get new customers. And one of the things we heard in our customer surveying was that our licensed buyers preferred gradual increases over time as opposed to the previous model, which was a one increase that was designed to last for 6 years. So as a result of that, we proposed and you all adopted incremental increases over the next 6 years. And I would just also mention part of the process also included new license concepts. So for instance, we have a new youth license, which is $10, covers hunting, fishing, and shellfish activities, includes the widely unpopular Columbia Basin endorsement, all for $10. It actually lowers the cost for families to participate. But that the fee adjustment wasn't our only, you know, we could have come and said, oh, we need to raise fees to fill this gap, but that was not our only approach. We looked at a number of other initiatives, including building efficiencies within the agency and downsizing the agency. So part of our approach to filling this budget gap included reducing or eliminating 48 positions. These positions were license-funded positions within the agency. And as recognizing that we needed to put ourselves on a more sustainable pathway as you move out into the future. And some of the actions that at the same time, we were taking short-term actions. So, for instance, we instituted an agency-wide four-month vacancy requirement. So for any position that was vacated, we were requiring managers to hold the position vacant for at least 4 months prior to filling. We also implemented agency internal recruitments only. So we were filling positions only from within the agency. We did that for a couple reasons. First and foremost, we did that because we knew we were eliminating 48 positions in the future. We wanted to maximize the probability that our staff would have positions, the staff whose positions were being eliminated. And we also did that because it generates the cascading benefit of vacancy savings from future vacant positions. And as a result of those actions, and because we identified the 48 positions for elimination very early, in fact, we identified them a year before their actual elimination date. So in August of 2014, we identified the positions that were going to be eliminated on July 1 of 2015. Many of those staff, in fact, almost all but one of those staff was placed, basically competed internally and moved to another position before the biennium ended. And when those staff vacated those positions, we did not fill them, even though we had the limitation and the position through the end of the biennium. We did not fill the positions. Because they were targeted for elimination, we left them vacant. All these factors, as well as our internal process improvements that we made as it relates to our accounts receivable, our federal funds in particular, really provided a short-term benefit as it related to our cash flow situation. And so as we look at the same figure, which shows the dedicated and obligated other fund monthly balances, as well as the license fund monthly ending balances.
Excuse me, Mr. Belcher, I'm going to allow, Representative Gomberg has a question.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and I know we want to keep questions brief as so we can get through the entire program. Mr. Melcher, thanks for being here this morning. This is a really interesting topic to me and I think to a lot of other people. You were just talking about internal promotions, filling vacancies from within the agency and essentially moving people up and then creating more vacancies down below, I believe. Could you help me put that in context? When I'm reading the Secretary of State's audit and they talk about 50% of your positions, particularly in management positions, eligible for retirement, what's that going to do long term and for the employee resources that we have in the agency?
Sure. Co-Chair Taylor and Representative Gomberg, we implemented that vacancy requirement as well as the internal recruitment during the last biennium. So we are no longer operating under that drawing a blank on the word, but we're no longer implementing that particular program. We're now actually openly recruiting for vacant positions. We did that during the last biennium to, one, address our short-term cash flow issues, and to provide the maximum opportunity for internal staff who are being affected by position reductions. So we're no longer doing that in the future. We're going open competitive now with our positions. That's not to say that our staff competes very well for internal positions. And many of those were not promotions. So many of those were lateral transfers. And in fact, in some cases, they were demotions, where folks demoted into an open position as opposed to staying till July 1 when their position was eliminated. So in the short term, it certainly helps. It certainly helped our cash flow. Long term, it's not the healthiest way to operate an agency, because you need new staff, you need as it relates to successional planning, you need folks waiting in the wings, if you will, as opposed to just recruiting from within. But at the time, we felt the right approach, and the only one we had really at the time to solve our own short term cash flow situation. And so as a result of all those factors, as we were aggressively managing the agency's budget over the last year, and as we look now at our ending fund balances, which are displayed here, same data set but extended out through 2015, you'll see that we have not only increased our ending fund balance but actually stabilized it. One of the things that we have struggled with over the years is wildly fluctuating monthly ending balances. And those are a combination of factors: federal receivables that were late, our normal revenue trend. Our revenue doesn't come equally distributed across the year. We have a sales cycle, if you will, that is reflected in our revenue stream. And over the last year, we've really stabilized that. To a great degree as a result of our internal process improvements related to federal receivables, but also and the increase was also a result of our efforts internally to really right the ship, if you will. I used the analogy that we had the rudder of the Titanic held hard to starboard for the better part of a year, and it finally came around. So we're pleased with that.
Yes, Senator Dembrough.
So is it too soon to tell how the summer went? In terms of license sales, the second half of the year?
Yeah.
Are they doing well, or?
We're going to get into that
okay,
a little
great.
Bit, because this wasn't just a result of our actions internally to control costs. It was also improved revenue. So, and we'll talk a little bit about that as well. So then moving just as opposed to the graphic depiction, the actual ending fund balance projections displayed in this figure, you'll see that our ending fund balance for the 13-15 biennium was $7.2 million. We ended the biennium with $16.2 million. That's license. That is our operating reserve, if you will. Other fund obligated, similar trend, albeit not as large of an increase, but projected ending balance of $9 million, ended with $11.9 million. And other fund dedicated with a projected ending balance of $9.8 million and an actual ending fund balance of just under $17 million. Some of these in the dedicated and obligated frames are due to shifts where projects that were going to occur in the last biennium did not occur, and so they've been moved forward into this present biennium. Nonetheless, a better outcome than having under or over projected our ending balances, no doubt.
Excuse me, Mr. Belcher, can I just have a quick question? Can you clarify for us, just kind of quantify what percentage of that ending fund balance is already for the obligated and the dedicated, since obviously you know, it's great in many ways that there's a positive variance, but what that money is already, just kind of give us a general sense of what percentage of that is already spoken for, if you will. I mean, it's all spoken for, but that's carrying over, because they're pretty large amounts, so...
I don't know that I can give you the specific percentages, but for instance, in the dedicated, that includes all of our restoration and enhancement. So we have a large restoration enhancement fund that's a surcharge associated with fishing licenses, and those are project-specific dollars that the Restoration Enhancement Board allocates. I think there were several large projects, or at least one large project, that was moved forward into this next, basically into the current biennium from the last biennium.
Okay.
We can get you the detail on that if you like.
All right.
But
okay.
So as we look and as we talk here really about the license fund ending balance, there were two major components. First and foremost, well, maybe not foremost, but first, our revenues actually came in higher than projected. So we saw a 3.5% increase in revenues. That was largely, well, there were several factors that contributed to that. We had some excellent fishing opportunities. Ocean conditions were really good, so we saw some very modest improvement in fishing license sales. We also had literally some of our commercial fisheries, in terms of the ad valorem revenue associated with those, was record high. I mean, I'll give you one example. The pink shrimp commercial fishery was a commercial fisher's dream, in that it was a combination rarely seen in commercial fisheries of record high volume and record high price per pound. And those translated into significant improvements in revenue, not only to the fishers, but also to the agency where we collect ad valorem associated with those landings. And then on the wildlife side, several sessions ago, legislation was passed that implements a penalty fee for hunters that don't report on their annual deer and elk tags. Mm-hmm. And the fee is set in statute at a maximum of $25, with the Fish and Wildlife Commission has the flexibility to set that fee anywhere up to $25. The commission set the fee at $25, and you know, our goal is to not generate any revenue from that. Our goal is to have 100% hunter reporting and not have any revenue. Over the last 3 years, our reporting rate has improved to 80 to 90%. But the 10 to 20% that don't report annually are still not reporting annually. So they're still just paying the additional $25 each year, as opposed to submitting their reports on time. So, and that we keep thinking that's going to drop off, because truly it's a fee that can be avoided. But at this point, we have not seen much drop-off associated with that mandatory reporting fee.
Madam Chair, so, Kurt, do you think that fee needs to go up, you know, so people will notice it more?
Co-Chair Taylor and Senator Dembrough, that may have an impact. I think there's some customers that just simply don't want to report and they would rather pay the fee. I also think that we would never achieve 100%. I mean, that would be unrealistic. But our targeted reporting level as it relates to confidence intervals that associated with our hunter harvest estimates, our ideal is at least an 80% reporting rate. And with the penalty, we've improved our, and let me just step back. Prior to the penalty, we had mandatory reporting, but it was mandatory in name only. We used the carrot approach in that if you reported on time, you were entered into a drawing for some special tags, and our reporting rates were typically in the 40 to 50%. Implemented the penalty, we're in the 80 to 90% range, which for our purposes, statistically, it's very sufficient. The $25 maximum is in statute. So revenues higher than projected. And at the same time, as we talked about earlier, our expenditures, while we had a legislatively approved budget for a set expenditure level in the 2013-2015 biennium, we underspent by about 5%. And that was a result of holding vacancies, filling positions internally, cascading effect of vacancies that are created when positions are filled internally, as well as a lot of good effort by all of our staff across the state to really be mindful and frugal in their approach to conducting their business. Also reduced our vehicle fleet. There's a number of things, and we could go into those details. But and we call out here large restoration enhancement projects that were not completed on schedule, so they were moved into the current biennium. That raises the question, so what are the effects of this in terms of the balance has improved, it's better than we projected. What are the effects of these actual 13-15 ending fund balances on our 2015-2017 budget execution? For us, restoration of working capital is still a priority, and I would say not just restoration, but restoration and maintenance of working capital. As a result of the current budget situation, our programs are now operating without any administrative restrictions. That is to say, they're implementing their program based on the legislatively approved or legislatively adopted budget. We will use localized administrative restrictions, basically looking at real-time budget execution. So how is a given project's spending compared to its legislatively approved budget, and will it adopt or adjust administratively to assure that we remain within that expenditure level. We do know that, as it's been widely reported, costs will continue to rise for the department. In particular, we know that our personal services inflation is likely going to be much higher than we had projected as a result of upcoming and increasing costs of the public employee retirement system. And while we projected in our budget a 2.8% inflation rate associated with fuel and energy and protein, all the things that we use to operate the agency facilities, we're looking now at, based on Department of Administrative Services instructions, at about a 4% increase in those costs, basically inflationary costs. And, of course, as a result of Senate Bill 247, our revenues are projected to be higher than last biennium. We raised fees roughly 10%, and as a result, we expect revenues to be higher. I want to talk a little bit about some of the uncertainties. I'll take a drink of water first.
Some members of the committee, Representative Buckley, Senator Devlin and Mr. Siebert and I have been talking with ODF&W about how they do their modeling, about how they come up with the projections and how they do the forecasting. So that's what this is in response to. And so what you've just heard is where they're at now, and that the fee increase that we voted on last session just goes into effect now. So this is not with any of the fee increases right. yet.
It just goes into effect January.
In January.
Yeah,
January.
That would be the first,
phase, the first of the three phases. So just want to kind of bring everybody up to speed about where we're at. So this is what's he's very nicely responding to our request to understand about how they came up with, you know, the costing of everything. So,
yep.
Thanks.
Very good. So I want to talk a little bit about uncertainties. There's a number of there's certainly variability in our modeling as we look out into the future. There's two primary sources of variability that I want to talk a little bit about. First is the price effect. And as I talked about earlier, we are competing in a marketplace for individuals' discretionary recreational spending as well as their time. And price effect can have an impact. Price effect would be the changes in buying behavior due to price changes. Under the best case scenario, no buyer is impacted. It doesn't change their future purchasing. In the worst case scenario, we do actually model, so our projections of revenue associated with the fee structure that's in place includes basically a price elasticity piece, which is folks who are on the margins that will choose not to participate. Or in other words, not to buy a hunting or fishing license. And we are modeling that at 2%. Under our worst case scenario, that dropout could be 4%. With the stepped approach that's in the current budget, that is the stepped fee increases over time, we don't think that we would see the worst case scenario associated with the price increase. Nonetheless, worst case, we would project to double the dropout rate. Additionally, there's sales variance that just is inherent in our business, if you will. This is variance that we have a difficult time predicting next year, let alone 3 years from now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now. And those are variances associated with factors such as the size of fish runs. And like I said, we have difficulty forecasting fish runs in the current year, let alone 5 years from now. Nonetheless, variability in size of fish runs, which translates directly or at least indirectly into license sales. Weather, certainly many of our ocean fisheries are very, very weather dependent. But that also holds true for inland fisheries. Particularly rainy springs are not good for trout fishing license sales. So there's other, not just the big global climate type weather patterns at play, but also just localized weather that affects sales. And of course, economic conditions. As the economy, if the economy improves, our prospects improve. As the economy declines, it generally results in some declines in participation. This sales variance.
Mr. Melcher, I'm going to have Representative Gomberg.
I'm sorry, I was trying to time my question before you moved to the next slide, and I may have gotten you too quickly. Looking over this slide, it seems like what we're really talking about are revenue uncertainties, and I would submit that there's another paradigm shift underway here, as currently 50% of the people participating in your programs are non-consumptive. And that is to say, not buying licenses or tags, and yet that trend seems to be increasing. And I would submit that another uncertainty we have is that paradigm shift of more people who are doing viewing than hunting or fishing. How does that factor into our uncertainties as we move forward?
Yeah. Thanks, Co-Chair Taylor and Representative Gomberg. I think certainly that's an important, very important point. We have House Bill 2402, which created the legislative task force to look at alternative funding models for much of the work that we do. Not necessarily alternative funding models for how we manage big game or how we manage recreational fisheries, because we have a good funding stream and source for those, but how we manage other species, and that legislative task force is looking at that very issue. We're going to talk a little bit more about it here. We really and strongly believe that hunting and fishing is still a critical part of our model, of our funding model. It's a critical part of how we do conservation in this state, how we fund conservation. And we're not about to abandon our commitment to that. In fact, we'll talk a little bit more about some of our efforts as it relates to recruiting, retaining, and reactivating hunters and anglers, because it is, as I showed earlier, it's 50% of the funding model right now, and it's a critical one moving into the future as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. So sales variance, we talked a little bit about that. We would, of course, we have a data set, if you will, of sales over time, and we can look at, statistically look at the variance in those sales. Representative Co-Chair Taylor that asked us earlier about, well, how about putting some bounds? How about putting some confidence intervals on these? So we get a sense, you know, as policymakers, we get a sense for what is the uncertainty, what is the risk associated with a point estimate of revenue projected out next biennium or three biennia from now. We had, you know, our economist has been looking at that very issue, and his approach has been that he would use three standard deviations above and below the mean as the variance associated with our sales, our licensed sales. And as a result, you know, in utilizing that methodology, our best and worst case scenarios as it relates to our sales estimates for the 15-17 biennium would be plus or minus 5.3 million, which three standard deviations, that's actually not too bad. I mean, plus or minus 5 million on a 95 or whatever it is, $99 million revenue estimate is, that's not bad in terms of statistics. And then lastly, this, we talked about these already, but economic factors certainly contribute to uncertainty moving forward, as does resource status. As fish and wildlife populations increase or decrease, that has a direct relationship on our ability to provide harvest opportunities for individuals. And so I want to talk a little bit then about our actual revenue model. And as we've talked about here already today, the Secretary of State's audit, both the financial audit and the performance audit, both referenced and cited that the department had used overly optimistic projections in the past in looking out into the future as it relates to our budget performance. And they said that improvement in these models was needed. We were actually already working on that. In fact, our economist, who I think came on staff in 2013, might have been 2012, but nonetheless, he has been working on a new revenue model since 2013 that we actually used in development of the 15-17 budget. It includes fully the license structure and price, individual pricing of those products, as opposed to just a simple deterministic model where we look at revenues. Old model was look at the revenues from last, you know, biennium, project them forward, add in things like interest, because when we carry a balance, we do generate interest, although right now we don't generate very much. But in the past, we've had interest was an important part of that calculation. The new model includes all the license individual license structure, as well as the prices associated with those licenses. It also integrates an elasticity factor. So The higher you raise the price, the larger the dropout is. In other words, the larger the negative response from participants. It utilizes actual sales data. So from our point of sale system, we now have our point of sale system, which is operated by a private vendor, but we now literally in the last several months have a replicated database. So literally real time, we get a replicated database from our vendor that goes into our SQL, into a SQL database, and we're able to actually make projections based on real time sales information, as opposed to in the past, we would literally have to get a data dump from our vendor, and you could not, it was just very cumbersome to do. This new model also, it provides the ability to both do forecasting as well as hindcasting. So you can look at your previous performance or how you would have performed under the current model assumptions. And we did use that model basically in the 13-15. So in 13-15, we've used that. And I don't know if that was a hindcast, Bill, or if that was an actual forecast, but...
13-15.
Yeah, it may have been a hindcast exercise, but nonetheless, it was a hindcast exercise for 13-15.
Just to clarify something, Mr. Belcher, you had said about the utilizing the actual sales data. That sounds great that obviously you can get it in real time instead of waiting for a data dump. Thank goodness for advancements in technology. But so how often are you doing that? Are you doing that monthly, or how is that working?
Co-Chair Taylor,
or the plan going forward.
Right? Yeah, Co-Chair Taylor, we've actually just very recently, I mean, within the last month, had the ability to do that.
Oh, okay. So it's brand new.
Yeah, so we'll be looking in the future here, and we have to decide that. But yeah, it will be certainly more frequently than once a year. I mean, I'm thinking monthly is a good start. I think right. Bill's working to develop kind of some dashboard type, you know, summaries so we can look at mm-hmm. not just the ending balance, because ending balance doesn't tell the whole story. Mm-hmm. You need to know the revenue and the spending piece. So Bill's looking at some of those in the future. Thanks. So just a recap of in 2000, the 2009-11 budget forecast, the 2011-13 license sales forecast, these were based on the old model, which the Secretary of State was critical of. Both of those models did over-predict by 5 to 6%. And this new model, as we use it to hindcast the 13-15 situation, under forecast by 2%. So we think it's an improvement. We're going to continue to track that over time. And I don't know, Bill, if you have anything you want to add on that or not, but... No. Okay.
Nothing. Co-Chair Taylor, like you mentioned, we are incorporating that into systems.
Excuse me, for the record, can you state your name, please?
Sorry. For the record, my name is Bill Herber, Deputy Director for Administration for ODFW.
Thank you.
Like Director Melcher stated, it is a relatively new process for pulling in that data from our point of sale vendor, but we are incorporating it into systems. Currently, we incorporate it into our model using a semi-automated process that we have to kind of engage in when we want to see that data. But as we move forward, we certainly are going to automate that so it's available near real time as well as at the same time with the replicated database. So we are moving in that direction for sure.
Thanks. So we've actually talked a little bit about this, but with the new replicated database, and this is just a graphic for, and you can't unfortunately see it on the screen very well, but literally for the first time with this replicated database, we have the ability to summarize and look at our efforts as it relates to recruiting, retaining, and reactivating hunters and anglers. We have a really good situation. We know who every one of our customers, and we know every one of them. They're in our database. We know who they are. We know where they live. We know their age. So now with the replicated database, we're actually able to look at across categories, across age groups, track our performance as it relates to their activities. And and we're going to use that. And as you look at this, and if you could see the graphics, which unfortunately you cannot, but
you can actually zoom in here. So
you can see that we've actually, if you look at the categories at the top, as it relates to participants and participant rate. Oh, there you go. Participant rate, new participants, and churn rate. Churn rate is the proportion of licensed buyers that do not buy a license every year. Mm-hmm. And we can actually track, and when we look at this, for instance, we see we've been doing a good job on new participants. Our new participants are increasing every year. When we break it down, though, into age groups, it's the millennials and the Gen Xers where we're falling short. So, you know, we're going to be able to use this to focus some of our efforts as it relates to recruiting, retaining, also knowing what's going on, knowing what our license sales are and our ability to manage our budget accordingly. We talked earlier about cash reserves, and they're clearly one of our key metrics for financial health. We talked about the recurring cash flow problems over the last 4 or 5 years. The cash balances, these monthly cash balances, are important for us to track our burn rate, track our accounts receivable, processing times, track towards federal reimbursement. Critical for operational reserves and emergency needs. Also, we have, and we haven't really talked about this here today, we've talked about it in the earlier ways and means process, but our objective has been to have an ending balance of, a monthly ending balance of $13 million. That's essentially about 1 month worth of operating expenses. When we look at some of the accounting principles out there for nonprofit organizations, you know, we see that some of the recommendations are that you should have 3 months of ending balance as opposed to one. We frankly picked one because we felt like it was something we could actually achieve without having to raise fees dramatically to just basically build balance. These monthly so I think Co-Chair Taylor, you had a question about what exactly or what precisely are the monthly operational costs associated with the Department of Fish and Wildlife. A number of different ways to calculate that. If we use the legislatively approved budget, the monthly costs are about $14.5 million monthly. If we use our actual spending, though, it's generally between $12 and $13 million based on actual spending patterns. Now, those fluctuate throughout the year. So at some times of the year, like right now, we're probably at our lowest point in terms of operational costs because we don't have a large seasonal workforce in place generally during the winter. As you get into May, June, July, August, when we have a much larger seasonal workforce, it's probably on the higher end. It's not the 12 to 13, it's probably 14 to 16 million. Nonetheless, over the course of a year, our actual averages are between 12 and 13 million per month. About 58% of that, or $7 million, is personal services. And the remainder of the expenditures are in the standard categories of service and supplies, capital outlay, and debt service. So ideally, you know, in a vacuum, if you will, our target would be more in the $36 to $39 million ending balance operational reserve. That's in a perfect world, recognizing that that may not be achievable. It's interesting, if you look, just a piece of history, if you will. If you look back, we've had a target of $13 million for several biennia now. If you look back to about 2001, we had a target of $15 million was our targeted ending balance in 2001. And our agency budget at that time was about, I think, about $210 million versus our agency budget now is about $340 million. So we've not adjusted our ending balance. In fact, we've reduced our ending balance target over time when we should have been increasing it to reflect the size of the agency budget. And the large piece that's federal accounts receivable, which we're a government shutdown away from having a problem with federal accounts receivable. With that, I guess, Co-Chair Taylor, I would... conclude, I do have a couple slides on some limitation requests, but before we get there, I would just offer that our in conclusion that we've made progress over the last year. We're certainly ahead of where we thought we would be a year ago in terms of ending balance. We don't think our work's done, and we're not interested in just maintaining. We're interested in truly having a sound ending balance that's going to sustain us for the long term as opposed to just the short term. As an executive leadership team at Department of Fish and Wildlife, one of our key objectives is that we put ourselves in a position to not need a fee increase in 2021 and to hopefully put ourselves in a position to be able to decrease fees in 2019. And, you know, that's for us, I mean, if just from the business operational side, from the constituent side, from our ability to recruit and retain customers, particularly the ones that are on the margins, we think that's really where we need to be moving into the future.
Okay, thank you so much. One of the things in all these conversations that we've been having about your budget is what the plan is going forward. And so you did a great job of explaining, you know, how you're changing the modeling and what you're doing, et cetera. Can maybe one of the two of you talk about, I know there's been some internal struggles about having, you know, about some of the training you were sharing and having your staff be able to do the level of detailed work that needs to occur in order to, I just kind of want to hear a little bit about what's the plan going forward so that we can kind of know where we're at as time goes forward, so that when 17 comes around and people are starting to discuss things like fees and et cetera, that what kind of analysis will be done between now and then. So can maybe one of you talk about that?
Yes, Co-Chair Taylor. As you've noted, we have a lot of things in play to further our ability to kind of execute the budget, and I think I'd want to focus on that. In the past, we focused a lot on budget development. Execution, we struggled with, given some of the capacity or capabilities within our agency. So we have been focusing on more budget execution. And in fact, in our budget shop, we've done some internal reorganization. They were decentralized a few biennia ago into the wildlife and fish divisions. We've pulled them back into a cohesive group currently working out of the director's office. We actually brought a limited duration staff on hand to augment their capabilities to push some of the daily workload down to the lower levels and leave our higher level fiscal analysts more in the budget execution role. Certainly our budget manager is taking more of that execution role. So kind of not only having the capability of the execution, but also putting systems in place to be able to do that near real time. Mm-hmm. And that's where we've struggled in the past. If we needed to look at these answers, it took quite a bit of work just to figure out where we were. Certainly with the replicated database is a huge part of it. Director Melcher mentioned that, you know, our revenues are a large portion of our budget. So being able to really track that real time and how it's occurring will allow us to execute our budget more in line with our revenues. And so system implementation is a key part of that, and that's something we're focusing on. Once again, the budget shop, you know, freeing that workload for them to have time to actually develop these systems. So between our ability to execute the budget and then system development, that's kind of where we're moving in the future. Mm-hmm. And we've made a lot of segues. For a lot of them, we're in this semi-automated process, our modeling program. The economist now can pull in that actual data. We could never do that before as easily, but it's still a little bit of work for them. So we're moving that into a more automated process where it is just a click of a button. That way, if we get questions on that, it's right there. We don't have to do all the work. And so that ability to look at this stuff real time and really make course corrections as we see variances is going to be key moving forward and kind of the strategy we're taking.
Thank you. So one of the other questions that I had asked is that, so now we have this I mean, first of all, thank you, and thank you for all of your hard work. I've asked them lots of questions, and they've been coming back with, you know, with good responses, and so I really appreciate that, and taking the cash flow management issue so seriously, because I think we all agree that that was something where there was room for improvement. Now we have the PERS situation coming around where that's going to be expensive, and I just wanted to see, you touched on it a little bit, but if you could explain for everybody going forward, you said potentially a fee decrease, which of course the public would love, but there's going to be the increase in PERS costs, and I was wondering if one of you could kind of talk about the plan to address that.
Sure. So, you know, I think when Co-Chair Taylor, Kurt Melcher, Director, mm-hmm. Department of Fish and Wildlife, I think we know that there's going to be these increased PERS costs. We cite them as one of the uncertainties, certainly as we move forward. And when we look at our agency structure out in the future, we're going to continue to manage within our legislatively approved budget. We're going to be very aggressive on the basically, hopefully, marketing and recruiting new or reactivating previous hunters and anglers. Every one of those, every license we sell above and beyond our base, it goes right to the bottom line. We're not building a car where there's the huge costs of actually putting the car together, and the fixed costs are covered. So part of our model here is that we're going to try and grow, albeit modestly, out of this situation, if you will. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've had participation rates in this state that were far, far higher than they are now. We've got certain communities that we know we can improve our efforts in, and we're gonna try and do that.
Okay, thank you. Representative Parrish.
Thank you. So, you know, you've been to the committee before. I appreciate all the work that you're doing, and I appreciate the constraints that you're under. And I want to ask sort of more of a philosophical question, because it seems like your agency, and I've said it before, is kind of like the canary in the coal mine, right? So you're fee-based largely. You've got sort of a declining participation. Doesn't change the scope of the work that we actually have to do, which is, you know, all the biology work and the protecting wildlife and making sure that we have good outdoor areas. And so the question I have is, like I said, sort of more philosophical. Like, if we had to, an example I'll use is when Hurricane Katrina came through, the school system in New Orleans got literally wiped off the face of the planet, right? They had to actually rebuild from scratch how they were going to do education delivery in, you know, post-hurricane. And I'm not advocating for the hurricane in Oregon, but if you had the opportunity to really redesign and revision, and you're not going to have an answer for this today, but something I want you to think about, because I think we're going to have to come back and find a way long-term to change how you do business, not just bite around the edges, you know, and try to raise fees and things like that here and there, but if you had to seriously redesign your agency, what would that look like? What are the barriers that, whether it's, you know, how you hire, how we kind of force you into, like, here's how we do benefits and all of that, like, what do we change? Because ultimately, 5, 8, 10 years from now, particularly as you have a population of boomers who no longer are out hunting and fishing, and my generation is not as excited about going outdoors to do those things, your revenue 10 years from now, 12 years from now, is going to be seriously declined, and yet your mission is still a viable mission, and we need to find a way to figure this out. So what are the barriers that we would have to maybe statutorily take out of your way so that you can be a fully efficient operating piece of our government, and not be a huge burden on the general fund? And what do we have to do to make that happen, so that, you know, where are the roadblocks so we can take the barriers out of the way so you can be as efficient as you possibly can and give you the flexibility to run your agency in a way that, you know, maybe we need to start looking at how each individual agency runs rather than treating you all like one big group, you know, which we do right now for everything from healthcare to how we staff. So you're not going to have an answer for that today, but it is something I want you to think about, because I don't want to be here in 10 years from now, but if I was, we'd be having this conversation, and, you know, theoretically you'll be on a crash course of broke, and the mission doesn't change. I mean, we still have to, you still have to function.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Harris. Did you want to make a comment about that? Because Mr. Gomberg has a question.
Co-Chair Taylor and Representative Harris, I don't necessarily have a full answer, but I do have a few thoughts. I think, you know, we talked a little bit about it, but House Bill 24-2, the task force is looking at alternative ways to fund fish and wildlife work is a piece of that. There's also some pretty significant efforts going on nationally. And so a little bit of history, but in 1937, the Pittman-Robertson Act was passed, and actually it was an Oregonian who worked on that. His name was Carl Shoemaker. He was formerly the Game Commission chief for about 20 years, I believe. And that was an industry-supported excise tax on arms and ammunition, with the revenue dedicated to wildlife conservation. There's some work going on right now nationally. The International Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies has convened a blue ribbon panel that's looking at other models that would be industry supported that would help fund so that we don't have to burden hunters and anglers with this bearing the sole cost of these programs. And they're programs that are important to everyone. And if you look at polling, you know, wildlife conservation is important to like 96% of the citizens out there. There's almost no one says it's not important. So it's really the question of how you pay for it. They're public trust resources that are held to the benefit of all citizens, not just people who hunt and fish. I like to take it to the extreme, and the same holds true for wildlife enforcement. I like to take it to the extreme. If there were no hunting and no fishing tomorrow, would we still need to spend money managing and enforcing fish and wildlife laws? We would. There wouldn't be any hunters and anglers there to pay it. So who would?
Well,
anyway.
Yes.
So my question, though, was not how do you get more money? My question, though, really lies to how do you change the cost structure of your management? Like, where are the roadblocks? I mean, because ultimately, each state agency effectively has a, you know, almost all of you are cost center in one way or the other, right? I mean, it's, you're serving the public, you're not a real, like, a business, except we don't also give you the flexibility to operate as efficiently like a business, and that could include anything from how to staff, how to do retirement benefits. Like, you don't have that individual control. We've come and said, we want to manage you, we want to have everything be uniform, and yet the service you provide is not the service the DMV provides, is not the service DHS provides, yet we treat you all the same. And so my question back to you is, if we were to sort of break you down and build you back up, what would that actually look like? And that's from on the cost management side as much as the revenue side, because I just feel really strongly we can't keep going to taxpayers saying, we need more money, and yet we're not changing our business practices. I'm sure if you had the opportunity to change your business practices, you could or you would in order to help solve some of this, and then we could really truly find out, okay, we've changed and tweaked all our business practices, now we're still short this much money. But until we do this piece, all we hear is we need more, and hunters and anglers are all hearing that too, but they don't see us actually changing how we do business. And I've said it before, you don't get to actually go catch an extra fish or hunt an extra deer, you're just asking you for more money. And so that's what I really want to get to, is if you got to start over and redesign your system, including how we staff and manage, and we had to break you off separately from how we run all other agencies, what would that look like? Because I would be interested in drafting legislation that lets you have the flexibility you need to run your, you know, you are sort of like a business because you're based predominantly on user fees.
Right.
What do we need to do to help you better, you know, have the tools to manage those user fees from a cost side of the ledger?
Thank you, Representative Parrish. So in the interest of time, Representative Gomberg has a question, so we can make certain.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thanks again, Mr. Melcher. Very quickly, I wanted to talk a little bit about ending fund balance, and I understood your explanation today that our costs were lower than expected, our income was higher than expected, and that had an impact on where we ended up. How did our ending fund balance this biennium compare to the last one?
Co-Chair Taylor and Representative Gomberg, I think we can actually glean that from one of these slides.
if we look at the ending fund balance on, it would have been July 1 of 2013, which was almost zero. Okay. On the other fund license.
Okay, and then I'm looking. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
this slide goes to October, but you were showing the slide showing that we were at roughly 24 million.
19.
Am I pulling that?
I think it was 19.
Yeah.
For the fund balance. So what's confusing here, if I may interject, is that here on this slide, they have licensed and obligated broken separated. And then in the pre-slide that was just up, it's combined, the dedicated and obligated with the red line is combined. So that makes it, it makes it more confusing.
And I would add, Co-Chair Taylor and Representative Gomberg, so this graphic is played out beyond the end of the biennium. So this shows our monthly ending balance through basically October, whereas the table here is summarizing the other fund ending balance at the end of the biennium.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference.
Follow up?
Yes, Representative Gomberg.
I'll skip over a couple of other questions I had for you, and I just want to get to the crux of it. And help me out here, Kurt. I've got to go home, and I've got to talk to hunters and fishermen, and you know that we sweat blood in putting together a package of fee increases. What do I say to them when they ask me about how fee increases have resulted in a substantial increase in ending fund balance? I understand your administrative charge in trying to put money in the bank and have operating funds that you find necessary to go forward in the event of unforeseen circumstances. But again, in simple terms, and my hunters are not simple people, but in simple terms, help me explain to them how fee increases translated into a substantially increased fund balance.
Sure. Co-Chair Taylor and Representative Gomberg, none of these ending balances that we've showed here were the result of any fee increase. They were the result of actions that we took to improve our financial position, as well as revenue increases associated with improved sales in 2015. The new fee increase, the new cycle didn't start till January 1. So none of these are reflective of the increase in fees. These are reflective of
I'll just follow up, and I promise.
It's fine. Yes, Representative Gomberg.
I understand that point completely, but they're going to say to me, the agency expected it was going to be losing money and therefore had to increase our fees. As it turns out, the agency made money. What do I say in response to that?
Co-Chair Taylor and Representative Gomberg, I think when you, as we talked about, there's always uncertainty on the revenue side. We were very aggressive. Our staff, all 1,200 of them, were very aggressive in their efforts to live within our means, or actually even better than that. And as a result, and many times, we don't know till the budget is closed what the final spending picture is going to be, but we underspent. I mean, we could have spent that $5 million. We had the legislative authority to do it, but we did not. And we did not do that. We did not spend it because we wanted to improve our ending balance situation, our monthly balance cash flow.
Thank you.
Representative Hack?
Thank you, Co-Chair. Thank you for the presentation. It's been great. I'm in the same position. Lot of pushback on the fee increases, and I was not supportive of that. So while I respect what you're saying and that your folks cut back, did within their means, should we not do that all the time? So if you're saying now that the reason you have a surplus is because you had 1,200 employees that lived within their means, basically, and you ended up with a surplus, then we went back and asked folks to give more based on a fee increase. To me, that just, I can't go back to people and say, well, they had a subsidy because they finally decided that they were going to shore things up, tighten things up, and live within their means, basically, and you still have a fee increase, and they have a subsidy. That does not fly to my constituents who are really outraged over the fee increases. So you got to arm us with something better than that. That concerns me. And while I get the fluctuation in in revenues. I understand that there are years that the commercial fishing industry is better than others. I get that. But at some, I mean, do we not do the fee increase because you have? Do we put that off for a year? Do we? I mean, I just, I don't know. I think it's, I'm in the same boat you are. People are not happy.
Yeah, I think Co-Chair Taylor and Representative Hack, the underspending of our budget, it was not without cost. We, as I think Representative Gomberg alluded to earlier, we were hiring only from within. We were eliminating positions and moving staff into those vacant positions. So I hope I didn't give you the impression that we could pull that off every biennium, you know, that we could implement these administrative restrictions every biennium, because in the long run it will be tragic. It'll be catastrophic.
And I understand that. So. I do. And I commend you for not spending what you said you could have spent, because there's a lot of others that do spend it regardless. So I don't want you to feel like I'm being critical of what you did, because I get why, and I commend you for doing that. You'd be worse off if you didn't. So it's just a tough position for us to be in, and I'm not sure what the answer is to folks. We'll have to wrestle with that ourselves. But I'm not being critical of what
Understood.
You did in that regard.
I'm just going to interject one thing, is that Mr. Siebert, Representative Buckley and Senator Devlin and I started speaking with them in August, shortly after the speaker moved me into this position. And of course, I had the same questions that all of you had. And so one of our first meetings was, and I went through some things on my own, and I said, I think we have a cash flow management problem. And they came to my district and quickly came to realize that, you know, we all kind of agreed that we have something going on here. And the timing of everything, which is what I think Representative Hack is referring to here and others as well, is very genuine, because there was a set of assumptions used, and then the fee increase happened. In addition, things changed in Mother Nature, let's just call it that. And so then we had more participation occurred. So we had all these very, very variables happening, some of which are controllable and some of them are not. But what we've learned now is that we need to, when we're doing the modeling, which is what they are now responding to, my request to change how they do the modeling, so that when these situations happen in the future, we can analyze them in real time. And so that's what they're attempt going forward, and we can work with them on that between now and the next session. Are you okay?
It's like something caught my...
Yeah. However, I've been very clear that, you know, we should be keeping it as an option open for discussion of whether or not to do the second phase of the fee increase, okay, and how to manage that, or the third increase. And one of the things that, you know, we've discussed is maybe we should have it in proportion to whatever is happening in the market, basically in the marketplace at that time. However, now we have yet another variable to throw into the mix, and that's PERS. So these savings occurred, some of them are one time. We then had better, you know, conditions for participation. We have a changing demographic of who's doing what, and Mr. Gomberg's bringing up a really valuable point that I hope that you heard, that, and also so did Representative Parrish, that younger people may not want to be doing this, and there's only so much advertising and et cetera we can do, and that may change. And so we'll have to keep an open mind about, for the health of the agency, of what we're doing, because we're responsible for all those people coming up behind us as well when we're long and gone. And so all these variables, some of which could have been predicted, some of which could not, but I think we've learned a kind of a tough lesson, let's just put it politely at this point, because the fee increase had to go into effect. There was no way to stop it unless we held an emergency session for January. And so I definitely think that we need to work with them and monitor the cash flow and monitor how the money's going to determine whether or not we should have the next phase of the fee increase. I think it's too early to tell, but I think it's definitely something we should watch. And so
So yes. I want to go back to something Representative Gomberg brought up, is that you're sort of the age of your workforce, and that you've got the audit, so you have what?
50%
that could retire.
It's a problem across government, a problem across government.
Well, it is, but it also presents, you know, when people do retire, I mean, you also sort of kind of go back and you have people maybe not at the top of their scale, and and I'm not advocating that you start pushing out your employees. I want you to understand that. But I would like to understand, though, what you think the repercussions are, and be, you know, and come back to us and share with us what sort of, there's also a harm in losing institutional knowledge too. 50% of your workforce is ready to retire. Do you have people who can backfill them? I mean, do they exist in the workplace, right? Do you have enough natural resource biologists, and do you have enough, you know, field technicians and all of the job categories that you have? So are we going to have a problem in the work with your workforce as well? What happens when you have 50% of your workforce who's eligible to retire and they go into PERS? What does that do with, you know, payments owed? And I would like to see us drill down on that, because I think you have some issues that could come out of the fact that your workforce is, you know, people who have really high degree of skill and knowledge, and somebody like, you know, like a Wayne Krieger, right? You can't really replace what is in that guy's head really easily. You know, he knows more about your agency than I will ever have in my lifetime. So that becomes both the challenge. There could be some fiscal implications for that. There could be some positive, and that maybe, you know, salaries readjust. I would like, when the next time you come back to us, maybe have some information on what you think are sort of the opportunities and the threats of having a workforce that is right at 50, half of your team at retirement age. I think that is a red flag for me.
Yes, no, I think it's a good point. Thank you, Representative Parrish, and welcome back, Senator Hansel, and Representative Gomberg.
Well, Co-Chair Taylor, I just wanted to thank you and the agency for putting this presentation together today, and particularly wanted to thank Co-Chairs Buckley and Devlin as well. I heard something very interesting today, and that is the possibility of a fee decrease in 2019. I hope we don't get to that point. I hope that rather than have an increase in 16, 17, and 18, and then a decrease in 19, that we can somehow find a way to avoid that third bump and factor that in a little more smoothly than constantly jerking the fees around for people. And I trust that you'll take that into account as we move forward, and that you mature as a chairperson in spite of the fact that you're doing a wonderful job here, I think, the first time that you've held the gavel.
I guess, thank you, Senator Gomberg. I think the idea...
don't insult me. I'm just a representative.
Representative Gomberg, sorry. I think the whole idea of that we've been working with them and asking to get the cash flow management under control, and that conversation started in August, and that's why I asked them to do certain things, because if we had a better sense of how the cash was coming in and out, then it would lead to better decisions and the forecasting as a result from conversations, what we've learned, and now from the audit, that how far you forecast out and what factors you use, what the assumptions are, matter a lot. And so we need to, and I think they've heard the message now, and we're looking forward, and you know, room for improvement, and we're going to try to focus on that going forward. So thank you.
Yes. Sorry.
Your concluding comments?
No, I'm concluded, but I do have two slides on. Do you want to do those, Paul? Or
no.
Okay. Thanks. Very good. No, I'm
yes,
very pleased to be done.
All right. Thank you, and we'll conclude the public hearing today. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
They're asking for some other fund limitations.
Thank you.
They're asking for some other fund limitations.
Thank you.